Well, the world is a dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right, and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got journalist, author, and the host of the Understand Suicide podcast, Paola Fontanelli. And this is Suicide Prevention Month, and I haven't talked about it very much yet. And there's a reason for that. Like a lot of you out there that I've been hearing from privately, and some of you publicly, actually, and thank you for that, we've all been feeling something. And I don't know if this is just the onset of a deeper COVID malaise that seems to be setting in with some people, or if it's something else entirely. But here we are. You know, I tend to think that I've got all of these things under control, and just because it's under control, it's not a problem. And that's not true. It feels true. It feels like managing something is the same as dealing with something. And that's absolutely not the case. It just kind of feels like that's the case. See, I'm a person who usually has some level of chronic pain. It's low level, mind you. Like, my back will be really sore. When I was younger, I dislocated my hip from skateboarding. And now when it gets cold, I feel it. But what are you going to do? You just kind of soldier on. So there's usually some low level of that ache, of that pain, in my back, in my hips, sometimes in my collarbone that I shattered. And I don't really notice it because it's always there. It's omnipresent. But when it's gone, I can't believe that I dealt with it for as long as I did. So you may be feeling something that you're managing, that you're getting through your day. You're waking up in the morning, you're going to work, you're taking care of the kids, you're walking the dog, you're making dinner, you're making plans with friends, you're going out for drinks, you're dealing with it. You're managing, you're spending your day to day, and so you feel like it's all under control. Why do we do that? Why do we sit in our own despair as if we are toiling at something great, as if we are getting through something and there's some sort of glory in not reaching out for help, or seeing how long we can manage it before we have to check in? Like, what level do you think you have to be at before you deserve a little aspirin for the ache? You know what I mean? Why do we question whether or not our feelings are valid, and whether or not we are enough, whether or not we deserve anything, be it happiness, be it love, be it just to exist on this planet without pain? Why do we do that to ourselves? I haven't figured that out. You know, I think about a glass of water and how it's made up of all of these molecules, and there's droplets. And do you think a glass of water laments that it's not the ocean? Do you think a glass of water even has the presence of mind to know that it's evaporating? Because we're all evaporating. We're all glasses of water evaporating. The difference is, I think we get to enjoy the ride while we're here. But it gets a little hard sometimes to recognize, oh yeah, sometimes it's great. When you're in the middle of it, when you're in the worst of the darkness, it seems impossible. It seems like it's never going to end. But guess what? It always does. It always does. Even if it comes in small moments, small little tiny moments of joy and happiness. That's amazing. That's worth it. That's absolutely worth it. And you, where's the camera? You are worth it. You're worth it. So whatever level of pain that you're dealing with, it'll pass. And we'll all be here waiting for you. Hanging out, just evaporating in our glasses like everybody else. So, this is the first video episode of Coffee Over Suicide. And you can check that out at youtube.com/randomify. And that's enough said. Let's get into this conversation with the amazing, the wonderful Paola Fontanelli. We're going. Hi. Welcome
Hi,
to the show. First off, right out of the gate, where are you currently located?
In Portland, Oregon.
Wow. What is the weather like out there right now?
It's beautiful. I have to say, these past few days, we had a few days that I was like, oh no, summer is over. But then it came back full force. Hmm. So it's been gorgeous here. And I live on a floating home.
Oh.
So right on the river. So when I get stressed out, all I need to do is just open the door and go to the
deck. That is amazing. My wife and I were just looking at a place like that in Canada, of all places.
Canada,
it's like
really?
It was for sale, and we were just going, you know, it just, oh, it looks,
I have to
it
say,
it looks so good.
It completely changes your life, really.
So let's go back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how you were as a child. What kind of kid was Paola?
Oh, you know, that's such a good question, because here's the thing. The memory that I have of it is so different from what people who knew me say I was. Isn't that funny? Yeah, the other day, actually, because when you go through counseling and other program to be a therapist, you have to do all this, you know, going back in time and write about yourself, your childhood. And many times when you have to do what we call the genogram, you have to call your parents, call people who knew you as a child. And then I started calling these people. They started talking about me and said, oh, that's not how I see myself. That's not how I remember as a child. So here's my version of it, okay? My version of me as a child was that I was very shy. I was kind of a very troubled, very internalized, very quiet kid, lived in my room. And I do remember this one time. I mean, a child, right? Very young, and I listened to classical music. I was listening to Tchaikovsky and Beethoven and all those, Bach. And I mean, a child, that's not normal, right? And I do remember right. One time hearing my dad tell my mom, what is with Paola? She lives in this world. She puts these headphones on, those big ones, round big ones.
Oh, yeah,
she
yeah, yeah.
She puts these headphones on and she lives in her world. So that's the memory I have of me as a child. But one of the things that I heard from people I interviewed about myself was, one of them was my closest cousin at the time. He was a little old, much older than me. And he said, oh, you are this very happy, talkative child. And I remember very affectionate. You would come and sit on my lap and hug me. And you were always, and that I believe I was, because I still am, very much, and that's very Brazilian too, very cultural. We touch a lot and we hug. And, you know, all these boundaries that Americans have, we never even heard of it. There's no, yeah. there's no, you have your space, I have mine. No, we all inhabit the same world in the same space. So it's how you would come and sit on my lap and just hug and just stay there, very, very affectionate, very, but very happy. And I was, oh my God, that doesn't sound right. And I would interview someone, say, oh, you're very talkative, very friendly. I said, no, that's not me. So these are the two versions. So you take whatever you like.
It's so interesting the way that we perceive ourselves is sometimes not even lining up with the way others perceive us at all.
Yeah. And I think that happens throughout our lives.
Yeah.
It's not just as a child. Yeah. I'm sure you've been surprised by what people say about yourself. I have been surprised many times.
Yeah, completely.
And I'll go, what?
Completely.
For example, I think I'm quite funny and I laugh easily. That's what I think. But most people say the first impression they have of me is that I'm very serious.
Yeah.
And I go, oh my God, there's something really wrong with this, with what I show and what I feel.
Well, and we all wear different masks in different situations too.
True. Yeah.
Because, you know, there would be times when I would go into work in an office. And one time I remember I had a boss come up to me and say, you know, everybody notices you're really quiet. And I said, well, if I'm so quiet, how does everyone notice me?
Notice. Do they notice my silence? Is that because silence is so, so annoying sometimes?
And then in any given circumstance where childhood friends versus coworkers are in the same place, they can't reconcile the fact that anybody thinks I'm quiet because I'm usually the silly one. You know, just quick with a joke or a bad impression or, you know, something. But so tell me about Brazil.
Oh, Brazil.
Come on. It's beautiful, right? But also lots of weather stuff too, right?
Oh, my goodness. Well, weather, when you talk about weather, it's nothing like what you have in the U.S. We are so blessed. We don't have hurricanes, we don't have floods, unless there is a sanitation problem, but we are very lucky. It's pretty sunny, depending on where you are. I'm from the Northeast, and in the Northeast, we have two weathers in the Northeast. It's either very warm or burning hot. That's the weather. We don't have cold at all. We don't even know what that feels like. But if you go to the South, because Brazil is huge, it's as big as the U.S. almost. So if you go to the South, then you have cold, cold weather. So it depends on where you are. But we're so, we're lucky people. It's a lot of beaches, beautiful ocean views. The whole coast, we have a huge coast that goes up from the north down all the way, and it's all Atlantic Ocean down all the way to the south, and it's just gorgeous. And then if you go to the left side of Brazil, so east side, okay, my geography is horrible. No, no, west side of Brazil, then you have the Amazon. So it's just as beautiful. It's not ocean, but it's still gorgeous, so differently.
Yeah.
But Brazil is such a contradiction. The Brazilian people, we are very much into living. We are very much into the here and now. It's about enjoying life. If you go to Rio, 5:30 in the afternoon, the beach will be packed with people.
Yeah.
They're done with work. I'm done with this.
Yeah.
If you go to São Paulo, it's a little bit different because they're very much into productivity, and they think that people from Rio are just lazy. So there's so many different little cultures inside Brazil. And in Northeast, we're all about enjoying life. We're very much into, we're very affectionate with people, very social. As I said, very different from here, these boundaries that you guys have here. I think it's so it's so funny. I always talk about a line. If you go to a line, any kind of line in Brazil, 10 people will occupy maybe 2-3 meters. I don't even know. Because here, it would be around the block because there's all this distance. we just don't. We don't care about these things. Here, you coming and people cross the street to give you space, right?
Yeah.
In the beginning, I would say, why? What are they doing? Am I contagious or something? And also the sorry, right? Yeah. Americans will come your way and they will apologize the whole way. I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. For what?
Right. Yes, completely. I mean, being from the Midwest originally, I can definitely speak to that. Yeah. I grew up in Michigan, and it was kind of a smaller town, but everybody was taught to sort of keep to themselves. You know, you don't look people in the eye unless you're looking for a fight or anything like that. And then I moved to Denver, Colorado, as an adult about 10 years ago or so. And everyone there was very friendly in the city I moved into. I mean, I moved into...
It's a shock, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a shock to the system. Because my first thought when people would say, how are you? Was, I don't have any money. You know,
what do you need from me?
Yeah,
what do you need from me?
What is this all about? Just forget it. It took me a while to warm up to that idea. And then, you know, now, of course, I mean, I walk up to somebody I'm meeting for the first time and it's all hugs and just, you know, it's just a better way to be. Just, you know, stepping forward with your arms open saying, all right, well, prove me wrong, but I think this is going to be a great situation.
we're all here in this together. That's one of the things we learned with COVID, right? Even though we still have to keep a distance.
Ironically, now we're keeping more distance than ever.
Yeah, ironically, you're keeping a distance for other reasons, but it showed everybody that no matter how much money you have, how old you are, where you're from, we're all in this together.
Absolutely.
When nature says, I'm done with you guys, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah. The only thing that that separates us now is some of us have nicer boats. We're all in the same ocean, but some of us have nicer boats or live in one like you. So, I mean, you've definitely had a lot of things happen in your life to get you where you are now. And before we get into the heavy stuff, I actually want to get into some of the joy. Which I imagine can be a little bit difficult, but let's start here. Can you tell me some of your favorite memories of growing up with your parents?
Wow, so many. I have so many good. So we lived in a house that was. For me, my memory of it as a child was it was this huge house. Now, of course, I look at the pictures, no, not so much. But we did have a huge yard that went, it wasn't a backyard, it was a yard that went all around the house. The house was in the middle and we had this huge yard with all kinds of trees and fruit trees that you can imagine. So we had coconut trees, we had banana trees, we had guava trees, we had a few mango trees. I mean, you name it. And I had so much fun. The best memories I have of my childhood were either sitting, because we had around the house, it's very common in Brazil, it's not like here, houses usually have a wall around it, a very tall wall around it. And I would climb the trees and sit on the wall. And now that I look back, I've always been very curious about human beings. And I would just sit there. That was my favorite thing. I would collect a few fruits along the way, a few mangoes, a few guavas, put it on my lap, and I would eat and just watch people and just watch them sitting and talking, because we lived in, there were many little houses. It was actually a slum at the time, and very little houses, very, very poor people around.
But were you aware of that?
Oh, yes, very much.
Yeah?
I was very aware of the contrast between where I lived, because we had moved, my dad and my mom, they built the house over the years. We didn't have much money, so when they told me the story that when we actually moved into the house, we had no doors. They didn't have money to buy the doors yet. So it took a few months to put the doors and windows. So anyway, but still, it was a huge contrast between where we were and everyone outside us, because it was a very low income neighborhood, but we were kind of the first ones to have a middle class house. So I was very aware. I was very aware that there was a huge difference between us. Many of them would do, for example, one of them was our gardener who took care of the garden. So another one, before we had washing, we didn't have washing machines, so someone would wash our clothes. So that was the, we were very privileged when compared to them. And I knew that, But still, to me, as a child, really, I would just walk out the house, go into their homes. I would go into everybody's homes and talk. We had friends. Some of the kids were our friends. They would come over. My mom and dad never made this difference. You know, there was no difference. So they, we would interact with them as neighbors. You know, there was no difference between you're poor or I'm more privileged than you are. So my friends were friends from these houses, and they would come over. They would spend the night. I would go to their houses. And I remember my favorite one was the guy who was a genius back then, entrepreneur, and he would sell like beer and drinks and all kinds of sweets. So every week my dad would give us our allowance. We would all run to their house and buy all the sweets we could. And he was smart enough to, we had tabs, so we could just buy stuff and pay later.
Yeah.
So, but that was my favorite house. I would go there all the time. Though my best friends were the kids from this house. So these are great memories that I have from my childhood.
What kind of things would make your father laugh?
Not a lot. No. My father, that's a good question. My father had a lot of interests in his life, a lot of passions in his life. One of them was classical music. I learned to love classical music because of my father. Reading was another passion that he had. I mean, every weekend he would go to, he had this huge room filled with, at the time, not CDs, but LPs, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So LPs, he had like hundreds of them and thousands of books. That was my dad's world. And he would, I remember, I would go there and sit down and he would tell me about this composer. Beethoven was his favorite. So he had a bust of Beethoven on his table. And he would explain to me the instruments and the stories behind that composition and that symphony or whatever it was playing. And we also, he loved dancing. My mom didn't like dancing. My mom didn't like music very much.
Really?
No. And so he would dance with me. I was the only, my sisters didn't like dancing either. So I was the one who danced with him. And I remember him teaching me how to dance tango. Tango is the hardest thing to dance.
Yeah.
And bolero, he taught me how to dance bolero. And I mean, we would dance and listen to music. So these are very precious. But laughing, oh my goodness, I don't have memories of my dad laughing. Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
He was a very serious man, very, very family man, very dedicated, but serious, yeah.
Yeah.
There was a heaviness in my dad that he was an alcoholic. So there were a lot of monsters there that as a child I couldn't understand and I many, many times hated it and it really distanced me from him. But of course I didn't know what, and I have to say I only learned some of these things that happened in his life after he died. So
yeah.
But he wasn't into laughing.
How old were you? How old were you when he died?
I was in my 30s, so it was 2005. Yeah.
Yeah. Your situation with your, so had you already moved?
Like out of to the US? No.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. I lived in Brazil then. I lived in Recife where I was born. I moved out of Brazil a couple of times. I lived in London for a while. I lived here in the US when I was 19 for 3.5 years. Then I went back. But even my hometown, I moved to Brasilia, which is the capital of Brazil. And then I moved to São Paulo too. But at the time when he died, I was living in Recife, my hometown.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you found out that he had died?
Yeah, so it comes in two parts, actually. I was here in the U.S. on vacation. I was in Miami. I had just finished a huge campaign. That's what I worked with, political campaigns in Brazil. I just finished that, got out of the way. And after a campaign, you were absolutely exhausted.
I imagine.
24/7 work, very tense. Yeah. So I had come here just to relax and enjoy. I'd been here for a while. Was in Miami. And the day before, it was a Sunday, my sister called me, my older sister Renata. She called me at night and she said, there's something wrong with Dad. There's something going on. I don't know what it is, but he came here today and he spent the whole afternoon. I could tell that there was something off. Sometimes I would see that his voice was kind of shaken as if he was going to cry. And I can't put my finger on it, but I don't know, maybe he's thinking about doing something stupid. I don't know what's going on, but there's something wrong. And she was very concerned about my dad. And I said, well, I'm coming back, because I was coming back 3 days later. And I said, don't worry, I'll be there in 3 days. I'll talk to him. And then the next day, I woke up with another call, and she was like crying and sobbing, and she could hardly talk. And she said, he took his life. And yeah, so I didn't have time, so I had to rush back to Brazil, and that's how I found out.
And what is your process? I mean, when a parent dies, it's it's definitely always hard. There's never a good time for that.
No.
But I mean, you've had this. You've had this life with this person so far, up to this point. You've seen the ups and downs and the difficulty, and now you're here, and you've got the rest of your family. Who's the caretaker at this point, trying to hold everybody together?
Well, a few years before my dad died, my brother died. He was into drugs, and it was a very difficult death for all of us. And I do believe that when my brother died, my father started his process of dying too. I mean, it was really hard for my dad. And in the family, I think I've always had this role of the strong one, right? The one who fixes things.
Yeah.
Who it's not just taking care of people, but I'm the one who, and it's a coping mechanism. I know now, I didn't know then, but now I know. I put this mask of, okay, I'm going to take care of everything. I remember, for example, in my brother's funeral, that I was watching everybody, how everybody was, kind of paying attention. And at some point, I looked at my dad and I said, he needs to leave. I said to myself, he needs to leave. He can't take this anymore. And I mean, that's how much I was prepared. I already had some medication because I asked a friend of mine. And I said, Dad, you need to go. You shouldn't be here anymore. And he was so out of himself, and he was just so confused. And he said, I don't know, but I have to stay. I'm the father. And he said, no, you don't have to stay. You don't have to do anything. You have to take care of yourself. You have to go home. And he was just so out of it that I actually gave him the medication. I said, take this and go home.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the role. And my sisters, they told me later that on that same day, I was the one who called everybody to let everybody know, called the friends. And because of the way he died, the media was there. But I was a journalist and everybody knew me. So I was the one who gave the interviews and talked to reporters and stuff like that. And so I was the one in control, right?
Yeah.
Until I wasn't. Yeah.
Right.
So I got home and I remember physically feeling like I was burning up, like I had a fever, but I was totally under control. And my sisters told me later on that they were looking at me and they were so worried about me. They said, when is she going to crash?
Well, yeah, because that's got to be difficult to have to set your own emotions aside in order to get some things done.
Yeah.
I saw the same thing happen in my wife when her mother passed. Mm-hmm. And her mother also passed from taking her own life. Mm-hmm. And it was a real rough situation because nobody was really equipped to handle it.
You never are. No.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's things to do.
Yeah.
There's things that have to get done. The thing that is so strange about all of it, for even just the people on the periphery of any death, is that brush with your own mortality that you feel, where you recognize how finite life can be. You take stock of what you're doing in your life, and you remember to tell the people that you love them. There's camaraderie, there's crying, there's closeness, there's mourning, there's remembrance, there's all of these things. But for the person who's holding everybody together, you don't get those things right away.
No. You're just fulfilling a role, right?
Yeah.
That you put on yourself. It's not anybody. Nobody was expecting me to do any of that.
Right.
Yeah. And when it came to my father, I had been, for the last 2 years of his life were really tough. And I had been, I think that was the closest I ever was with my father as an adult. Because again, I took charge. And I was the one who talked to him about, you know, all the financial problems and all the things that he was starting. He started a new business that didn't work. He was in a new relationship that, although was working, came with a lot of responsibilities because the woman had two kids, were very young, and my father was felt responsible for them. So there was a lot going on, and it was very, very hard for him. I said, Dad, you need to see a psychiatrist. You're not well. I could tell that he wasn't well.
Yeah.
And he actually went to the doctor, saw the doctor. He was diagnosed with depression, but pride.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't happen to me. And my father was like a military man, very strong. Are you kidding me? Me with depression? No. So never took the pills, never treated his depression. But I was very close to him, and I knew what he was going through. So much so that I didn't have a lot of questions. I knew why he did what he did, which is very, it's the opposite. It's very common for you to just have all this. I had all the questions.
Yeah.
But I knew what was going on internally with him. But it's something that I don't do to myself anymore. I don't put myself in that situation anymore. Now, today, I give myself time to mourn, and I know how sick it made me in both cases, with my brother and with my dad, how sick I was afterwards, because I couldn't give myself space to grieve.
Yeah. And how long did it take afterward for you to be able to grieve properly?
It was, okay, here's how I deal with situations. I'm very curious, and when I go through some kind of pain, I want to understand it. So I go to my head, right?
Yeah.
I go immediately to my head. I avoid my emotions and go straight to my head. And say, right. How can I understand this, right? It's like a teacher. I want to understand as much as I can so that I can teach somebody else. So here's what I did. I immersed myself in books about suicide. Okay, because I didn't have any history with suicide. I didn't know anybody before. And in Brazil, there was nothing. So I bought books from here, from Australia, from the UK. I mean, everything I could find. And I started reading. So one side of that was very positive because it has a lot of value. Understanding, it has a lot of value. So it helped me with my grief, but at the same time, I was reliving my father's death without grieving, right? That was a catharsis for me. It was a way for me to deal and process my grief, but it wasn't properly grieving. I wasn't giving really myself emotional time to grieve. So what happened, as is kind of expected, after a year that he, after he was dead, I started feeling really weird. I said, there's something wrong with me. I would be with friends in a bar, and I remember one specific day that we were having a good time, and this darkness would just take over. And all I wanted to do was run away from that place and cry. And yeah. I would have these bouts of crying, I mean, out of the blue. But again, I called a doctor and my physician, and I said, listen, there's something wrong with me. I don't know if it's depression. It feels like it. It's been going on for too long. And I remember the high point of that made me decide to see a psychiatrist was traveling has always been a passion. I've been everywhere. I travel like crazy. And I was in New York with a friend of mine. I had planned this trip. I didn't enjoy a minute of it. All I could think about was going back to the room and cry.
Yeah.
So that's when I said, okay, there's something really wrong. So I did all the tests with my doctor, and she said, no, he's a psychiatrist. That's my personal doctor. You have to see. And I was diagnosed with depression. And I think that was the moment when I decided I'm not doing this to myself again. I'm not waiting to get sick so that I can grieve again.
Yeah.
And actually, my father's death, his suicide, changed my life. After that, I decided to write my book. I published a book on suicide prevention. And then I started my work that I do until now, over 15 years, with suicide prevention, with families, with grief. That's my passion now. And I changed professions. I said, I'm not doing journalism anymore. And I did my five-year training in psychoanalysis, then a master's in clinical mental health, and that's what I do now. I deal with families. I have the podcast and the book and YouTube channel, you name it.
Well, tell me a little bit about that book, because it did quite well for you in Brazil.
Yes.
And it sounds like that was something that wasn't really so much a part of the conversation that you had when you were growing up.
No.
And so to have that as a resource for other people now has to feel incredibly gratifying.
Yes, very much so. It was the hardest book. I have 3 published books in Brazil, 1 here, but 3 there. It's the book that I'm mostly proud of by far, because it was so hard to write. I stopped twice because it was too much.
Yeah.
And I had to give myself time, and then I would go back again. But I had decided that I needed to write the book, not for me, but for families who were going through the same thing and for people who were thinking about suicide. Because there was nothing in Brazil back then. Believe it or not, the stigma was so huge. And it's not that long ago.
Yeah.
And that's what surprised me. When I started searching for answers, I couldn't find anything. So yeah. I said, no, as a journalist, it's my mission. I have to fill the gap. So I did. And it, as you said, it's still kind of a reference in Brazil. It was the first one. It was a finalist in the Brazilian Book Award. Because, as you said, it was just not there. The conversation was not there. The stigma and the taboo, nobody talked about it. And
right.
It has really changed since then, I have to say, and I feel very much a part of that.
Well, and even though you didn't necessarily write it for you, there's a lot of things that you probably had to get closer to and work out in a way that you hadn't before writing the book. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
Very much so. I'll tell you a funny story. When I finished the book and I submitted it to a publisher, the publisher called me. He was a journalist like me, and he said, "Can we meet? I love your book, but we need to talk about it." I said, "Okay." And I said, "Okay." So he came over and came to my house. We're having coffee, and he said, "Listen, I see the journalists here. It's great journalism. Great. There are facts. There are data. There are great interviews, right?
Yeah."
But where is the person? I don't see you. I don't see your father. I don't see why you wrote this book. And that's what you need to write, because otherwise I'm not publishing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he said, buy a Kleenex box and yeah. write about your story, because that's what's going to make people buy your book. It's not about the facts. It's about your story. What brought you here?
Yeah.
And that was the, that's what a great publisher does, right?
Yeah,
that's what
of course.
A great editor does. And it totally changed the book. And I have to say, every time someone comments on my books, it's about the stories. It's never about all the rest. You know, so I added 3 new chapters. I divided into my my childhood, my teenage years, and my adult life up to the when he died.
It's kind of amazing the way that the sort of intellectual part of your brain, the clinical part of your brain, can want to just look at things like a problem to be solved. Like, once I get the equation correct, that's the end of it.
I nailed
like,
it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, when you're dealing with these pesky emotions that don't always make
sense.
It's
about stories. And that's the thing that I learned with my book. I mean, I knew this because of being a journalist, but journalists are very much about facts, right?
Sure.
And, but I learned that we don't connect with numbers and interviews and facts. We connect with stories.
Absolutely.
And you know, as you mentioned, I had to go to places that I had never been before. And I'll tell you the one big revelation that I had about my father that was really scary to me at the time and a huge surprise was what I did was I started interviewing his family members who were very distant from us. And I started interviewing family members. And one of the people I interviewed was his best friend, lifetime best friend, who was married to his sister. So his best friend, but also brother-in-law. So here I am with my uncle that I loved. We're having dinner in my house. And I tell him, okay, you know what, uncle? Can you tell me a little bit about my grandfather? Because I don't know anything about him. When he died, you know, my dad wasn't even married. He was 12 years old, very young. And I tell him the story. And I see my uncle just leaning forward. And I see his forehead. And he's like, what the hell are you talking about, Paula? Your grandfather, he died when your father was 12. Who told you that? And he said, my father told me that. That's the story I know. I said, Paula, you met your grandfather. And I was taken. I was silent. No. I met my grandfather, the one who died when my father was 12.
Yeah.
Where did I create this story? And I said, no, okay, hold on. I'm not crazy. Because I thought that I had created this story in my head.
Yeah.
I called my sister immediately and said, Renata, my older sister, Renata, what do you know about grandpa? And she told me the same story. Oh, he died when dad was 12. Blah, blah. I called my other sister, same story. And then I called my mom. Mom, what the hell is wrong with you? Where were you when he told us this story? So here's what I find out. And it totally changed the way I saw my father from that point on. And I said, okay, tell me the story. Because there is something. Why did my father feel that he had to kill his dad to us?
Yeah.
That he wouldn't talk about him. So then my uncle told me the story. So as I told him, my father was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And he said, your grandfather was an alcoholic. And he was really sick at some point. He was taken to the hospital. And the doctor told him, if you drink again, you're going to die. So my grandfather leaves the hospital, goes straight to a bar, drinks, and dies on the way home. Can you imagine the shame? Not only the shame, but when he told me, everything was clear to me.
Yeah.
About my dad. So for dad, it was a mirror that he did not want to look at.
Yes. Oh my.
And I was speechless. I said, oh my God. All my life, I believed in a story that was a lie. But now I understand why he had to do it. He couldn't go there. It was too much of himself in his father.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, the stories that you learn, and that's what I learned throughout my book, a lot of stories. But that was the big one that just, wow. If I hadn't written that book, still today I would be telling you that I never met my grandfather. He died when my father was 12.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the secrets, family secrets, right?
You know, it's so strange the way that the way that our parents become people, like as we get older. And you realize that they're human beings with mistakes and you know, flaws and things like that. And it's such a strange thing to come across these things, you know, to recognize their fears. And I've had similar situations with my parents over the years, just discovering stuff. Like, I don't remember a lot of my dad when he was drinking because he quit when I was little. But what I do remember is I remember that for a while there, and I'm able to piece this together with what I know now. When he got out of his rehab, he was a pretty miserable dry drunk for a while. He was pretty upset all the time. Just you know, he was doing what he was supposed to do, but
but
he was not happy about it, and he was going to make sure everybody knew it. And he was grumpy, and he was loud, and the other thing I remember is there were cups of half drank cups of black coffee everywhere. In the house, just absolutely everywhere. It was, he traded in from one thing to another. One of the things
happens
that
a lot,
absolutely. And I think that's kind of where I got my taste for coffee from, because I would, I had no idea that it was my father's coping mechanism. I just knew, you know, this is the drink that dad likes. And, and I would take sips of black coffee and just kind of, you know, it was so bitter. I didn't like it when I was a kid. And, you know, now that's all I drink.
Wow, it's your podcast, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about your podcast. Okay. When did you start your podcast?
Okay, so after I did that, I published a book. So I created a website, did all my training in Brazil. And then I, 4 years, almost 5 years now ago, I came here for my clinical mental health master's and started working as a therapist. But then when I got here, I realized all my stuff was in Portuguese. I could reach so many more people if I did this in English, right? So that's when I had the idea of starting the podcast. One day, I don't know how, but I think I was getting into podcasts and said, well, you know what? I love being a radio reporter. That's what I was for a while. I should do a podcast. And then I said, because in English, and I'm going to do it in English, it was really hard for me to decide because, you know, I have my people in Brazil, but I said, no, I have to do this in English and to reach more people. So I created the podcast actually on September 14th, so next Tuesday, it's 2 years. So two-year anniversary of the podcast. And I started, the first one told my story, and then I started interviewing. So I interview clinicians, specialists, people who were touched by suicide, either family members or someone who lost a friend by suicide, or attempt survivors. I listen to a lot of those because I think there's so much to learn. So anything related to mental health, but always my main focus is to always bring a message of hope. Because my audience, they're suffering. They're either at risk for suicide or they lost someone to suicide. So there's a lot of grief interviews with people who lost someone to suicide or clinicians who do grief, right? They do grief therapy. So it's always about bringing coping mechanisms, new skills, new different ways of seeing your life, reshaping, renaming things. So it's about hope. It's called Understand Suicide, but it's about hope and bringing some kind of message of hope. And I'm quite surprised, and that's when you see that it's so prevalent, suicide, that the podcast now, it's over 100. Last time I looked, I had listeners from 112 countries.
Yeah.
That's a lot. And it's on the top 3% of audience in the world. So it just shows the need that's out there. So today I have the podcast. I have the YouTube channel that has the same title, Understand Suicide, where I interview, but I talk about books too. I do book reviews. I do other things on the on YouTube channel. So it's the podcast, the YouTube channel, the website, understandsuicide.com. And now I have an online course, how to help suicidal people, because this is the number one question I get. I know someone who is suicidal. How can I help them? So I just launched an online course for anyone who wants to learn some skills and how to approach them, how to talk, what to avoid, when, and if should you met, is it a case of mental illness or not, how to know, or can you really? So it's a very, very extensive course online that gives you, I mean, at least the answers that I've had collected over the years.
Yeah. Well, I absolutely love all of it, and I can't wait to read the book. But thanks for talking to me today.
Yes, thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me. And I love your work, too. I love the title of your podcast, and I love how you call it Dramedy. I love it, because we have to, as I said, even on mine, you see that it's very light, even though the subject is not, but I always try to make people laugh, and it's about hope. It's not about suicide itself.
It's always good to put a little light in every dark corner.
Yes, for sure. There's so much out there. Thank you.
And there you have it, the very first video episode of Coffee Over Suicide in the books. Did you watch? What did you think? Do I have a face for radio or what? If you want to get some more Paula in your life, and I know that you do, go to understandsuicide.com and subscribe to her podcast of the very same name on Apple Podcasts and everywhere podcasts are found. It's a really great website. It's got all kinds of resources above and beyond just links to the show. You can find her book there. As for me, you can always find me at youtube.com/randomify. I'm Coffee Over Suicide on the Instagram, and I'm trying to be better, not just about this, but about everything. So until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.